All right, welcome back from lunch. Everyone got fed and is not going to take a nap after the lunch. But we have an exciting session here. We have an exciting panel, a full panel, and nearly a full house. So people are probably still coming in, so people will probably sneak in next to you. You guys have been here now for the day, so you know the deal. Turn your phones off, and we want to always engage in respectful dialogue. So, you know, if you can't do that, you gots to go. But I'm sure everyone is capable of doing that. So this session is 90 minutes. It will be recorded. You can buy the recording once it'll be up, I think, to purchase in a couple weeks, something like that, to purchase?
No, they can purchase it. Today.
Oh, you can purchase it today.
At the end of the day.
Oh, awesome. At the end of the day. Okay. The name of this session is God's Name in Vain, Using Faith to Harm Others. So we have a big panel, so I'll go ahead and just get started on reading about each of them. So Lindsay Hanson Park, I don't think anyone her no, we don't know her, but she's somebody, is a women's rights activist, a feminist blogger, and an advocate against gender violence. She is the assistant director for the Sunstone Education Foundation and the founder of the Feminist Mormon Housewives podcast. Her work has appeared in the New York Times, Washington Post, NPR, Los Angeles Times, and many Utah publications. Next, we have Trevor Jeffs, who was born and raised in the FLDS Church, where he was brought up in a polygamist household in the strict cult community. He has since left his family and the community and has been overcoming the indoctrination he was given and making his way in the real world. Kristen Decker was born in the AUB polygamist group. She left at age 50 after raising her 7 children in polygamy. She attained a BA in education, wrote 50 Years in Polygamy, Big Secrets and Little White Lies, became a speaker, advocate, life coach, and the founder of the Sound Choices Coalition. Next to her, we have John Nielsen, who was born and raised in the FLDS and who was forced out of the community in 2004. We also have C. Jane Kendrick, who is a writer, blogger, columnist, speaker, and community activist. For 8 years, she has cultivated her award-winning blog, cjanekendrick.com, where she writes about life, religion, birthing, wifehood, motherhood, womanhood, body acceptance, her love of community, and all spaces in between. For the past 4 years, she had worked on Provo's most exciting culture event, the Rooftop Concert Series. As founder, co-producer, and host, she has always written for the Deseret News, Arizona Republic, Segula, and published a book of her essays called See Jane, Enjoy It. But to her family, she's Courtney, wife to Christopher Kendrick, and mother of 4.
That's a super long bio. Sorry, I'll
just
cut that out.
And last but certainly not least, we have Stan Shep, who was born in Pennsylvania to a Catholic mother and a Lutheran father and raised Catholic. He converted to mainstream LDS Church in 1989 and studied Mormon fundamentalism extensively before joining the Centennial Park community. So each of them has prepared about 10 minutes of content, and they'll get up and speak. We're going to hold all of our questions for after, and we're going to have a question and answer session. We're going to try to get that out on time, though, so I'll be on everyone about time. So, all right, Linz.
Okay, you have to look at an awkward picture of my face really quick. So this is a unique grouping of panelists, and it was actually, I've been kicking around this panel for a long time and figuring out what I want to do, because obviously I do a year of polygamy podcast. That's something that I do, the history of polygamy. And I've met so many wonderful, wonderful people on all sides of the spectrum. A lot of practicing polygamists who have become dear friends. So we have practicing polygamists on the panel, and we have people that have been harmed by some of these groups. And I thought, you know, where is it that we can all come together? Where is something that we can all come together? And when I talk about Mormon polygamy, I always tell people, I don't have a problem with polygamy. My issue is not with polygamy. It's about a system of oppression that harms people. And if I'm going to define my work that way, then I have to look in my own backyard. So I come from the LDS tradition, and it kind of irks me when we, you know, look at the FLDS, for example, Warren Jeffs' group, and we say, they're so messed up. and we refuse to look at the problems in our own backyard. That's something I feel very strongly about. So I've gathered a bunch of Mormons from all different kinds of Mormonisms, and I want to talk about this idea about how faith can turn dangerous. Now, I'm going to tell my own story really quick. As an LDS girl, this is me and my best friend Malia. I'm giving her a facial in college. We were doing makeovers, and that's the only awkward picture I could find of her and I today, so that's why you got this picture. She was my best friend. She had always struggled with her faith, and I was very, very active, very, very committed to the church. We went up to Utah State together. That's us in our apartment. And Malia started disassociating herself with the LDS church, and that really, really bothered me. And I would try to get her up on time and get her to go to church, and she wouldn't go to church. So it grew and grew, and so, you know, Mormons are anything but direct. So I never talked to her directly about it. It was always passive-aggressive. Are you sure you don't want to come today? Are you sure? Because I think we need the blessings, that kind of thing. And it festered, and I couldn't talk to her about it. And it came a time that her favorite band was the Smashing Pumpkins, and they were coming to Chicago, and she had met a guy on the internet before it was cool. It was when it was still weird. And she met him on the internet, and they were going to go to this concert together. And so the weirdness of that, coupled with the fact that she was traveling with a boy, was the last straw for me as her best friend. And so when she left on the concert, what I decided to do with pure intent and a righteous heart was get all the roommates organized against her. We decided we would move out her stuff because she was in a hotel room with a boy, not doing anything, just in a hotel room with a boy, that we were going to take a hard stand, that we couldn't let our morals, that as her friend, we had to stand up for what we believed in, and we had to show her that she was making the wrong choice. So she got back from Chicago. I had also told her mom about it behind her back. Her mom was there waiting at the airport, and her dad was there to tell her that she was not allowed to come to her home. And she came back to her stuff, and it was gone. And I was really proud of myself that I had taken such a hard stand, because I grew up believing the harder something is, sometimes that means you're doing the right thing. So my friend Malia didn't have any choice. She ended up moving in with a boy that she met on the internet. Turns out he's a great guy. So got off the hook on that one. But I remember at the time, there was something deep inside of me that said, don't do this. You don't need to do this. But it was consumed and overwhelmed by this feeling of this righteous like crusade that I have to show my friend. I have to teach her a lesson. And it's probably one of the cruelest things I've ever done in my life. We're fine now. I've made amends. She tells me to stop talking about it, but here I am. It's a really good lesson to me. It reminds me of what religion can do and how it can make someone like me, and I like me, do some bad things in God's name. And so I want to say that because when it was a hard thing to word this topic, because I want to talk about fundamentalist thinking versus being a Mormon fundamentalist. I have practicing Mormon fundamentalists that are friends. We have some on the panel. Being a Mormon fundamentalist often gets associated with this extreme behavior, and that's just not accurate. I was an LDS woman, and I had these fundamentalist thinkings that actually got worse and worse and worse. So that's what I'm going to talk about a little bit. Then I'm going to let them share their stories. Now, this is a study that was done that actually talks about terrorism, religious and secular terrorism, and the comparison, so you can look at that in the background. But how I've defined this in some of this research is there's three tiers of this spectrum. And the first is fundamentalism. And that's just faithful adherence to fundamentalists. It was the term was first coined within the Protestant community. So just adhering strictly to tenets of a faith, right? And I hate to break it to you, LDS Mormons, but we all do this in our own way, right? I just had coffee this morning, and it's been like the third coffee I've ever had, because my whole life I adhered strictly to the word of wisdom. That's something that I did. There's nothing necessarily dangerous about being a religious fundamentalist, unless your fundamentalists are like, you know, terribly racist or homophobic, like tenets that make you act on something. But religious fundamentalism coupled with some characteristics can get dangerous. And then the next level for that would be what I call religious hostility, which is what I believe I was engaging in with my friend. I was doing hostile things using my religion. And of course, as you can see, this is a secular thing, but there are some distinctions. And in this particular panel, there are Mormon distinctions. The third one is religious terrorism. And that's where we see, you know, extremists, suicide, terrorism, things like that. But I'm more interested in talking about religious hostility because, again, I think it's something I feel very passionate about based on my past experience. And all of these people here are going to engage with the subject in different ways. And some of the things I would say is religious terrorism, but some of it isn't. So for individuals... this is just a story from the Bible. To be religious and hostile, psychologists have come up with a list, and one of those things is to maintain a delusion. So a delusion is a harsh word when associated with religion, right? No one wants to be delusional. But a delusion might be that your worldview is set a certain way. So in my worldview, it was that going to a hotel with a boy was wrong, like so morally wrong that she deserved to be punished. That was my worldview. My worldview was very small. I thought that there were consequences for these things, and when those consequences didn't happen, I invoked my own consequences. Don't recommend doing that. So the second thing you do to become from a fundamentalist to a religiously hostile would be to demonize anyone that criticizes you. So anyone that challenges your worldview, you have to demonize them. Another thing that could happen is sexual misconduct. We see this. This is something that is rampant in the LDS community, absolutely rampant. Again, it bothers me when we say, like, look at all those fundamentalists doing all these things. We have a huge, 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 gaping, swallowing, encompassing issue in the LDS church with sexual misconduct. A lot of this can come from insecurity of one's position. So if someone does not feel secure in their position in the group, they are promised, in my particular group, the LDS, young men are promised positions of leadership. And so if you can adhere more extreme to the fundamentals than others around you, then you feel like you're earning your way into a position. It can also, that insecurity in your position in the group can also lead to an unquestioned certainty about your position in the group. You can start becoming delusional about your position. You can believe that your position is absolutely solidified with a stamp of approval from God, and that it can justify any means. This is a story from the Bible. Our scriptures are full of stories like this. So this is one that's very familiar to Mormons. This is the story of Nephi cutting off Laban's head. And of course, this story, I believe, has been used to probably do more harm in God's names within the context of Mormonism than any other scripture that I can find. And it's actually led to religious terrorism. If you know anything about the LeBaron group, who went and actually murdered people using this sort of rationale, religious terrorism is involved when you take those things that I told you and you include some other components, and I'll talk about those just really quick. Psychological isolation is one, physical violence, substance abuse, sexual misconduct, and more of the demonizing critics. So in some of the groups, like the LeBaron groups, they were physically isolated. They were psychologically isolated. They had lack of access to education and to resources like that. So when you take all of those and you couple it with your religion and you have a door here that says it's okay to do some things that are hard, that are maybe really bad, that you have a moral, that your moral compass is telling you not to do it because you got God's stamp of approval, that's when we see religious hostility that can be turned into religious terrorism. So that's just kind of the opening that I'm giving. And I just wanted to share my experience and remind everyone that it is not limited to polygamous groups, that this is not about polygamy. This is about us looking in our own selves to see what ways we use fundamentalist thinking in our own lives. Okay. First, Rebel Laverne.
Hello, everyone. Can you hear me? I was raised in FLDS. I left about a year ago, so this is just kind of some of my story about how it was living there. I really started doubting the church when I started working away from home around the age of 15. I started a job as an apprentice for a low voltage company, which was part of the church. I mean, it was everyone in that was part of the church.
I'm so sorry, but we can't hear you up here.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
I'll hold it closer. Okay. I didn't. We weren't allowed to have any worldly media like TV or movies or music, but I was a bit of a rebel. I started watching movies and TV shows while I was working away from home. I didn't have my parents to keep an eye on me all the time. They probably regret that I had so much leeway and unsupervised access to the internet. I worked two jobs away from home for about a year apiece. In that time, I got my first smartphone, and it was like a window into reality. I remember whenever I had enough data coverage or Wi-Fi, I was on YouTube or something, just watching whatever I could. I mostly watched silly TV shows and stuff. I also started listening to music and audiobooks. The audiobooks were some of my favorite discoveries. I could listen to them just with headphones while I was working or traveling, and it was discreet. After I moved back home, I started working with my dad in his machine shop, and I started watching other shows. I remember the first time I watched the Harry Potter movies, I'd always been told that they were of the devil and evil witchcraft, but I enjoy them a lot. Once we moved back to Colorado City, that was when I had lived in Colorado, the state. When we moved to, we were in hiding. We were kind of distant from the rest of the church, so it wasn't as strict. But when we moved back to Colorado City, then the church authorities started talking about the United Order and preparation for that. We all had to get baptized again, which was a bit strange. I never understood it. And we started preparation work for getting into the United Order. We had to get rid of any media that we had and repent. The confessions didn't start until everyone was baptized, but we had to confess all of our sins in order to become worthy. I remember I deleted most of my media, but it didn't last too long. I remember the first time I went into an interview with the bishop, he asked questions like, "Do you only think pure thoughts? And have you had any association with apostates? Have you partaken of worldly things like movies and music?" And another big one was, "Have you had any association with girls?" I remember just before I went into that interview, we had been on a business trip to San Diego, and I had downloaded a bunch of media from the internet on my computer, so I wasn't clean. But I just told them what they wanted to hear, and they says, "Yeah, you're worthy. You can come in the order." So I was as surprised as anyone. I thought if the church authorities had the inspiration of God, they would have seen right through me. But of course, there was no inspiration, so I just started getting ready to become part of the order. We had to catalog everything we owned, from how many pairs of jeans we had to how many spoons and plates were in the kitchen. I was over 18, so all I had to do was my own stuff. I wasn't very thorough, but it was still a lot of work. We had to give anything that was not a need to the storehouse. I didn't do too well on that either. I had a guitar and a computer and other things that wouldn't be considered a need, but I kept them anyway. I'm glad that I did, though. Once we got everything cataloged and sorted, and we had to bring all of our possessions to the storehouse and donate them to God in our hearts and minds, and physically for like an hour or two, we had to just go and walk around the building, and then we could bring them back home. It was strange. To get into the order, yeah, we had to get baptized and get some special ordinances again, so I've been baptized 3 times. Once we were in the order, then things started to get even weirder. It was a community storehouse, so everyone gave their income to the church and then would just request what they needed, and it would be provided if possible. There was changes in food and drink and other areas. We couldn't drink coffee. We couldn't eat pork or corn or chocolate or beans for a while, and then they said, eat beans. alcohol was frowned upon, but then it became banned. We had to put on our clothes a certain way, clean our house a certain way, get rid of any kind of entertainment, toys and games, bikes and rollerblades. A lot of people had to get rid of their computers. They started doing strange prayer circles in the United Order where all the elders would gather several times a day and pray just in a big circle, arm around each other. I was called on once to pray. It was really strange. But that didn't last long. I'm not sure why. After I got into the order, the command to not use the internet came down. We had to get any device that could access it restricted, and the internet was removed from all the businesses. That was when I started thinking, this is crazy. We had someone from the church come to the shop and take all of our smartphones and put some restrictions on it so we couldn't access the internet. It took me about 2 hours to take that off of my phone. I was using up a lot of data on my phone, and we had a business plan, so my parents started to notice that I was using a lot of data, and they confronted me, and that's how I got removed from the United Order and put into the Restoral Repentance Group. For a while after that, we still lived in the same house, but we couldn't live in the same room as someone who was in the order. But at the end of that year, then they separated the United Order members from the non-members, so three of my brothers and I had to move out of the house, and we moved into an upstairs office in my dad's machine shop. I lived there for about 2 years with three of my brothers. It was pretty depressing. I was pretty ready to leave and be done all with it all several times, but I didn't really have anywhere to go, so I stayed for 2 years there. Once I had completely lost all belief in the church, I didn't have much to keep me there. I finally gave my parents a letter explaining that I didn't believe and I didn't want to stay in the toxic environment, so they told me that if I didn't want to abide by the rules and teachings, I couldn't stay there. So I packed up everything I owned and moved down to Phoenix to work with my cousin. We had a fairly large family. It wasn't one of the largest in the community. My dad has four wives, and I think we have 23 or 24 children. Ours was a fairly normal family until our second wife, my dad's second wife, got married. At first, it was almost like having a big sister. She used to play with us, and she taught us school for the first several years in homeschool. When we moved down from Salt Lake City to Colorado in 2002, we moved from a decent-sized house into a basement of someone else's house. It was quite a different culture in Colorado City than it had been in Salt Lake. We started attending the FLDS Community School. I was in the middle of fourth grade. The school was called Jeff's Academy, and Warren was the principal. My teacher was one of Rue and Jeff's wives, and my teacher's assistant ended up becoming my fourth mother. That was an interesting coincidence. After Warren took over the church, he started sending men away and splitting up the families. One of those women whose husband had been sent away was the sister of my father's second wife, and she got remarried to my father and brought three kids into the family. So that made our family go from a fairly normal size one to a pretty big one, maybe normal as Mormon standards. We were still living in someone else's basement at the time, so it was still pretty tight. We finally moved out into our own house, and it made life a bit more bearable. The fourth wife got married a year or so later. When we were commanded to move my dad's business to Las Vegas, so I stopped school about the middle of eighth grade, and I went down there to help my dad in his shop. I think that was when my connection to the family started to dwindle. We were always split up. Some were living in Las Vegas and some in Colorado City. We had a small house in Las Vegas, and we shared it with others of the employees of the company, so we didn't have a whole lot of room. Then when we moved from Las Vegas to Colorado State, we lived there for several years, again, just commanded by the church. I never really understood why. That's when I started working away from home, and that affected my relationship with the rest of the family. I think it separated us even more, and it made me somewhat self-reliant. I was working away from home about 2 years, only coming home to see the family every few months or so. After I got laid off from my job, I started working for my dad again in a machine shop, and I never really got close to the family again. I'm not sure why, but I always had been different and thought differently from most of the FLDS people. I think that's one reason why I never felt like I fit in. After we moved back to Colorado City again, they started implementing the United Order, and that further separated the families, both physically and mentally and emotionally. We moved out of the house, and I never felt like I was really part of the family anymore. We were just there to work and make money and become worthy of getting in with the order to move back with our family. This is about the confessions. In order to be considered worthy of the United Order, we had to be judged clean and pure, and you had to confess all your sins and go in for an interview. They would interview everyone individually and ask a bunch of questions about your cleanliness. I remember the first confession letter that I wrote and how it makes you feel. It's a way of controlling you with guilt and shame for things that you may have done years and years ago. They rebaptized everyone, so I never understood why we needed to confess and repent of the sins that we had committed before we had been rebaptized. I wasn't completely truthful with my confessions, but they never knew that. They always thought I was a good boy and that I was going to become a great part of God's kingdom on the earth. I guess I was just good at hiding my true feelings from the people. When I started to research things outside of the church, the church's dogma, I saw that it was just a way to control and manipulate people with the fear of losing their families and loved ones and holding their confessed sins over their heads to convince them that they had to do all the doctrine or else they could be sent away and lose everything. I remember looking into the definition of a cult for the first time, and I was surprised how much the FLDS fit almost every point. They would strongly encourage us to write letters to Warren on a weekly basis, confessing our sins if we had committed any, and reaffirming our loyalty to him. I remember that my brothers had to call into the bishop's office every night and report in and tell them how they were doing and if they were staying clean. I was supposed to call in a few months after my brothers started, but I only made one call. It was when I was in Las Vegas for a business trip on my 21st birthday. So I just played some video poker and got a drink from the bar, so I thought that was ironic. They would use the pressure to report in to make you feel guilty if you didn't call in or if you'd committed any sins. So in conclusion, from what I've experienced with the fundamentalist mindset and the control and almost absolute power the leaders have over the people, it makes me sad and angry that there are so many people who can't or won't see that they're being manipulated and controlled and not getting anything for it. I think education and open-minded curiosity is one of the only ways to overcome the brainwashing and control of information that the fundamentalist church has. Thank you.
I'm Kristen Decker. I was born and raised in the Allred Group, or the AUB Group. My father was Owen Allred, so he was considered the prophet of that group for 28 years. My mother was his first wife of 13 wives. That didn't count all the women that he was sealed to for the hereafter. And what's fun is finding out how many brothers and sisters I might have if I make it there someday. People I had no idea about. Even one of I wrote about in my book, the gal, I'm not sure I'm using the right word, but the other woman in my husband's life who basically in the end ended up with him as was going to be possibly a third wife. And one of my friends came and said, "Oh, did you know that she's going to be your sister in the hereafter in another world?" And I was like, "What?" Yeah, she said, her mother married your father. And so I keep finding that out. You know, there's many more wives coming along everywhere. But basically, my take on this using the Lord's name in vain, or excuse me, God's name in vain, same, is about my whole life. I always, always questioned polygamy, being born where I was, why am I here? Why is my mother so sad? Why am I so sad? Why are so many people so sad? We put on those happy, wonderful, smiling faces and believed with all our hearts we were doing what God wanted us to do. I believed that. I knew with all my heart then what I thought I knew, that this is what I had to do to make God happy. And I believed it. And I remember when I was put my sister wife's, the first sister wife's hand into my husband's hand, and my father was performing that plural marriage, and I was very unaware of what would happen. I hadn't been to many plural marriages, and the other girls that I had been to put on their smiling, happy faces and said, "I'm so happy to do this." And one of my friends had actually coached me. She'd married one of my brothers as a plural wife, and then she had to do the same process and give her husband other wives. And she said, "Let me tell you how you do this so that you can save face, so you can look happy and wonderful and make, you know, this look good, because that's what you're required to do." And so she coached me on how to do that. And I stood up with that smile on my face and thought to myself, "Oh, I'm so happy to do this." And so, but inside, I thought I would die. My husband's going to go off with another woman and on a honeymoon, and it's never going to be the same. Our relationship will never, ever again be the same. And I remember that right then I was questioning again, what am I doing? My soul is telling me something's wrong with this picture. Something's not right here. I'm having to give my husband other wives, and this just does not feel good. And I can't imagine a God that would do that to other women, that would interfere with their relationship with the husband. Yet, okay, I'm going to do it. I was told all my life from the time I was born, this is what I needed to do. I even had a testimony. I believed it, that that's what I needed to do. And when I go back and look at my childhood and the many, many times that my soul guided me and said, "This isn't right," the times I was molested, the times that that my mom would be in her room crying and dad had left over and over again to the other wives, and my mom was sobbing, and then I'd go in and say, "Mom, what's the matter?" And she'd say, "It's just me. I'm the bad. I'm the wicked one. I need to get over my feelings. It's not the principle of plural marriage." And that's another thing that I was raised with over and over and over again, that we need to protect the principle of plural marriage at any cost. That meant we could lie. Whoops, that was sacred, Lindsay said. Those weren't lies, they were sacred. But we could lie as much as was need be to cover up or protect or make the polygamy look wonderful and make our families look beautiful, make us look happy. I can't tell you how many times I told people it was perfect and wonderful when I was inside crying and miserable and sad. And I saw that all around me. I saw that with my sisters, my brother's wives, my aunts and uncles, and my father's plural wives. Yeah, we loved each other because we wanted to love each other. That was what we needed to do. We made it work. We did the best we could. But every time I questioned, and I even remember getting baptized at 8 years old. We went out into Tooele in this little warm pot and got baptized, and I didn't really even know what that was and why. And I was confirmed with the gift of the Holy Ghost that I was supposed to listen to that, and I was supposed to listen to my soul. And I was supposed to obey that and pay attention to what that still small voice was telling me to do. And every time I did, when I was told that those two men that were majorly on the priesthood council were, something was really wrong, my parents told me not to listen to that because they were called of God. And they're good men, and they were called to that priesthood council, and they were our leaders, and so I shouldn't question them. I shouldn't wonder what's wrong, and every time I get around them, I feel sick. You need to fast and pray more, Kristen. Something's wrong with that. And so I was told over and over, every time I questioned, put that on the shelf. That, oh, we don't know. That doesn't matter. Oh, well, what about that person over there who's crying? What about the my niece over here who's locking her children in the closet? Oh, don't tell anybody. We'll handle that. And we can't have anybody knowing because we need polygamy to look so wonderful. And the principle of plural marriage is wonderful, by the way. So those are the things I would say is using the Lord's name in vain, God's name in vain, is not honoring ourselves, not listening, not being accepted, and even listening to our children when they say something like that. I remember one time, excuse me, I had those jealousies. I believe God gave us those reasons for purpose to say something's not right with this situation. And I remember one time crying myself to sleep, but the next morning I was so mad at myself and believed that I was so evil because I had those feelings, because we're supposed to get over those and be better than that and behave ourselves. And the next morning one of my sons said something, and he was just little, I think he was 7, and he said, well, if Diane hadn't come into the family, then we would have more. We would have this and we would have that. And I just scolded him. And I was taking my own heartache and my own nightly frustration out on him. You can't talk like that. That's not fair and that's not right. But guess what? It was the truth. The more there were, the more things were separated and divvied, and we had to give her the TV. They didn't have the TV anymore. You know, it was the truth. And so we had to just consistently put away those heartaches and put them on the shelf and deny them over and over from the time I was a child. And just a titch about that is, you know, when you're told over and over to follow your leaders, follow your elders, do whatever they say, they're the priesthood, they're the ones who are the righteous people. And so you got a man or an older sibling or a cousin or somebody molesting you, and you know it's wrong, and your soul's telling you it's wrong, and yet in my head I'm supposed to honor and obey them and do what they tell me to do. And so those are many things that come to my mind about not following our heart and our soul and the still small voice, if we want to call it that. And I'm grateful to be here. Thank you very much.
I guess you can't hear me. I'm John Nelson. Somehow Lindsay got me to do this, but originally, I was just going to print this out, and she was going to edit her presentation. I don't know what changed. But anyway, I was born in the FLDS as well as Trevor. And, I'm obviously a lot older than him. And so when it was smaller, you know, I had a good life. I mean, we had some good times. I've always had two moms. My second mom came when I was 6 months old, which happens to be Warren Jeff's sister, by the way. But so I've always known that family. I've always been around them. And we were very strict, just like Trevor said. You know, fortunately, I was kicked out in 2004, so I got to miss a lot of what he went through, which I'm really glad for. But probably the main reason I got kicked out is the reason I'm here. I was too free of a thinker for them, and they didn't like that. They didn't like me asking questions. I always asked questions, and they didn't like that. But what I mostly wanted to do today You know, there's been a lot of focus around Warren and what he's done, you know, as Trevor's just explained. I was having problems with that group long before, when Warren was just a nobody. And I mean a nobody. He wore dorky little glasses, and he was a nobody. I've known him since I was 5. So I was just going to read some stuff. When Lindsay told me what she was going to do this on, they you know, using God's name to harm people, I was quite well read. Our family, the Nielsen family, we're quite well studied and quite religious people. In fact, my uncle is the leader of a group still. I wished he wasn't, but he is. So, and somehow in fundamentalist groups, you know, there's an inherent harm because they don't want to let a leader retire. He's 82, and he needs to just retire, and they won't let that happen. And so then what happens is people like Warren come along, and then they misinterpret some good meaning of some good men, and they take it and they just misinterpret it. And that's all I see in all the groups today. I see a bunch of men who want to misinterpret things, because these all groups, at least the ones that believe in Joseph Musser, they all believe that you need 7 wives to have your own planet. That means 6 boys are leaving the community, because the birth rate's about 49 to 51. I think that's in favor of the boys, so we're already short. So there's already an inherent danger with these groups. And I don't want to be known as an activist. I mean, my two mothers, I never saw them fight. Honestly, I never saw my two mothers fight, ever. But by the time I was married and the friends around me and my social group were all getting their second wives, none of them were happy. Every single one of them, the wives were fighting. They were unhappy. And I started thinking, wow, I'm going to start going to movies and stuff because I don't need another wife. So I started getting on the fringe in the mid-90s because I was getting kind of scared at this program. But what I mostly wanted to read today, and I hate reading stuff out of context. I really do. And you can actually get all this online. Brian Hale has scanned in a ton of fundamentalist documents. It's MormonFundamentalistDocuments.com, and he has scanned in a ton of this stuff. So you can go read all this not out of context if you want, because I really hate doing this. But in the interest of time, I'm just going to do it real quick. MormonPolygamyDocuments.com. So this was in, and Warren, these are all from the sermons of Leroy S. Johnson, who was a prophet in the FLDS from almost 40 years probably, till 86 back, I don't remember the date, 53 or something. And these all mostly, the reason I wanted to do this is most of these I didn't learn about by reading them. They were quoted to me by Warren in numerous different Sunday schools and churches. And I went all through high school with him, and I've been through that school. I was his first graduating class, so I got to experience him learning how to run a school. But I was going through these real quick. This was in 1959, and I've heard this many times from Warren. The Lord can't use boys and girls that have been taught unclean things in their homes. At first, he used it to get rid of older brothers. Now, he uses it to get rid of what he considers parents that are teaching their children unclean things. This was given in 1959. Warren was born in 1955. He didn't invent this, running the boys off bit. This was given in September of 1974. When a young man will take advantage of a young woman, he severs himself from the presence of God, for God has said it. And so, I mean, that was in 74. That was their attitude. If you were doing anything with a young girl in 74 in Colorado City, you were gone. And I had friends that were starting to go away. I was wondering, you know, when your best friend is just gone, not showing the meetings anymore, and you're trying to find out, why, where are you? You know, we didn't have cell phones back then. We weren't texting everybody. Really, the only time you got to see your best friends was at a church function. It's like, oh, yeah, he ran away. I'm like, oh, that's kind of weird. He seemed pretty happy to me. I've since actually gone and found, of the 5 friends I knew that were sent away, I've actually flown around and found 4 of them. And they've all told me the same thing. We didn't run away. Brother so-and-so hauled me off to such and such distant relative. I'm like, in the 80s? Really? And he's like, yeah. So this was in 74 again, Colorado City, Arizona. We have had to invite men out of town because they wouldn't leave our girls alone. This was in 75. You girls know when the servants of God say to leave the boys alone that you ought to leave the boys alone. You boys ought to know to leave the girls alone when you hear the servants of God say to leave the girls alone. And in those days, we were pretty well watched. It was just casual socializing even that they were down on. And you know, this is in the 70s. This was a long time ago. This is in 1977. And what I want you guys to see on these just quick little excerpts is they were intensifying. This is in 77 in July. Some girls who have been set by good men will not take their place. The Lord says there is nothing left for them but to be destroyed. Now this is the same, this is a 40-year prophet of that church, 40-year prophet. You could see as he aged and progressed, he was getting more and more strict. You know, there's more and more shortage of girls. There was more and more grandsons growing up that didn't have any wives. I mean, they're mathematically just drawed out. Seven wives, one man. But in Excel, it's really easy to do. There's not enough. This is in October of 78. Our women, our young girls, long for a time to come that they can be turned loose, a lot of them, and do as they would like to do. So, I mean, he's become aware that not, as Kristen would say, you know, not everybody wants to be a polygamous wife. But when you need seven, everybody kind of has to. And then this was given in 85. From now on, sentinels will stand at the door, and men and boys with long hair will have to go home and have a haircut. I don't want their fathers to step up and say, listen, that's my boy. I'll take care of him. Any man that does that is not worthy to come to priesthood meeting until he repents. So by 85, the same man, you can't even come to my meeting house if you're going to have long hair. It wasn't just stay away from the girls. Now it was long hair. And if your father's getting in the way, you guys can't come in either. And now we have what we've seen. Obviously, everybody's probably seen the news media. I mean, I don't really like to say much about Warren. I don't. Just Google him. That's all you got to do. But I just wanted you to see the progression of as these groups get larger and as they try to adhere to their fundamentalist tenet, which is basically seven wives to have your own planet. That's really, really dangerous belief to have. And then you take, you know, not to pick on Lindsay, but you take Lindsay's, her desire to, she wanted to do the right thing. Her friend was doing something wrong and she was going to stop it. You take that kind of a belief and remove all the checks and balances, which basically, you know, the Mormon church has a first presidency, they have their quorum of the 12, I think they have a high priest quorum, don't they? And they have a good half dozen quorums to keep things in balance. Fundamentalist groups usually have one or two. Some of them might have a few more apostles, but usually they all kind of do what the most prominent name says of the decade. So a lot of checks and balances have been removed from Mormonism, turned it into fundamentalism, and it becomes really, really dangerous for young men Trevor's age, all in the name of God. And a lot of these men aren't as well off as Trevor. I've met a lot of these boys that have left, and they're not near as well off as Trevor. They're just confused. They're just like, my life's worth, I'm out of here, my wife's worthless. So it's inherently dangerous for young men. And I guess the point I want to make is I believe in freedom of religion. I don't have a problem with polygamy. But these groups need to be aware of the costs. You know, one or two young boys leaving, it's too high of a cost for me. Whether it's true from God or not, that's not what I want to discuss. But those are my thoughts, and thanks for listening.
Okay. Hi, everybody. I think we're all kind of guessing what Lindsay wanted us to say up here, but I think maybe I'm here because I represent more of a mainstream Mormonism sort of view. I grew up in Provo and in a big family of nine very religious children and to a larger, very religious family. And I guess I'm here to say that being extreme and harming others doesn't just happen in the extreme offshoots of the Mormon religion, but it happens in our own. And I'd like to share a story with you that happened in my family that maybe some of you can relate to, and maybe you can't, and I'm just strange. I work for the city of Provo with Mayor John Curtis. And as my husband and I have raised our children in Provo, we've decided that we would be very proactive and progressive in our family. And so we do whatever we can to make sure that Provo is a place of inclusion and acceptance for everybody, because as maybe some of you know, Provo has had a PR problem with that in the past. And it breaks our heart when people come to Provo, for even if they're BYU students or if they come and they buy a house and they live in Provo, to feel like they are just constantly being shoved to the fringe, or they're not accepted, or they feel like they are they're too much for the Provo for the conservative Provo community. And so we kind of, my husband and I have kind of decided to make sure that this is our life goal, as long as we can stand it, to make Provo a place where everyone feels accepted as much as possible. And I want to believe that this is like a real heroic experience that we're having, my husband and I, but the truth is sometimes I'm really angry at people, and I say bad words. But I want to share an experience with you, and I think it's interesting. We're all kind of talking about family, and I'd like to share an experience with you that happened in my family. My siblings and I, a lot of us live in the same neighborhood, and we are all on sort of a political spectrum. And Mayor Curtis, in my work with him, he has brought UTA into Provo to provide a bus rapid transit system into Provo. Now, this might seem kind of random, but just follow me here. So this bus is going to be trying to mitigate some of the traffic problems that we have in Provo. And one of the problems that people in my neighborhood had with the bus, the BRT is what we call it, is that the bus was going to be coming up 9th East in Provo, which is near our neighborhood. But it's also near BYU. And so part of the reason why we have the BRT is to shuttle students to and from places. Now, the idea is to not only lessen the traffic load in Provo, but to also increase our air quality. So there's a lot of reasons why, I think I'm preaching to the choir here, why we need public transportation. So my family was completely split about this. There were some that thought that the bus system would ruin our family neighborhood. And then one day, I woke up to a op-ed that my brother-in-law had written in the newspaper about BRT being against the proclamation on the family. which of course we can laugh now, right? But when I read it, to my horror, I was like, what is he doing? What are they saying? And essentially he was saying people that use buses are not family people. So if you I know you can look it up, but I'm essentially he was saying that the paragraph in the Proclamation of the Family that says we call on officials of in governments to uphold the family. Essentially, he was saying to the mayor, you are desecrating the family by bringing buses by a family neighborhood. So, of course, I texted my sister and said, "What are you doing? Like, this is awful. This is religious manipulation. You're making people feel like they should feel bad for wanting a bus system." And she felt like she had a confirmation that God wanted them to write this op-ed in the Daily Herald. And so I know we can laugh about it now, but it was not funny for a while. And it's still not funny. We in family dinners, we do not bring up the BRT, but I remember calling my dad and saying, "Dad, I need to know what's your stance here, because I think this is awful." And I'm fielding calls from people constantly saying, "Do you think this? Do you agree with your brother-in-law?" And it's tricky because my family were both my sister and I are public bloggers, and I didn't feel like I could say I think my sister and my brother-in-law are crazy. And my brother and my dad said, "Yes, I think the proclamation is a little bit crazy, but I think he's right that essentially buses ruin family neighborhoods." And it was a struggle for me, and I remember I just lost it at my dad, and thinking, can I do this? Can I live in Provo, where there's this extreme? There's extremism, and it's part of who I am, and I have felt it in my life. I was a vegetarian for a long time because I felt like that's what the Word of Wisdom wanted of me. And then I thought, if I were even more religious, I'd be vegan. So I was more spiritual than the vegetarians because I was vegan. And I remember going to girls' camp and being a part of a ward where our bishop was Samoan, and he brought up a total spread of Samoan food, and I remember being like, "Well, I'm even more religious. I mean, spiritual than my bishop, because I'm not going to eat that pig he roasted for us, you know." And essentially, what I did was hurt his feelings, and essentially, what my brother-in-law did was hurt many people's feelings. People's feelings in our city who do care about BRT, and many who need to use the bus in order to take care of their family. And so I think it's easy for us sometimes, and I'm not saying we're all in the same spot here, but it's sometimes easy for mainstream Mormons to look at our FLDS brothers and sisters and say, "Oh, they're extreme," and not notice that it happens in our own community. And I just want to end, I was writing a column for the Deseret News. Talk about extremism. I had a column with the Deseret News. Anyway, at the last presidential election, and John Huntsman, I don't know if you guys remember this, but John Huntsman, somebody asked him about his Mormonism, and he said, "Well, it's complicated." And that had major ripples in the Mormon population. I don't know if you remember, but we were all talking about it. And he said, "I come from a long line of saloon keepers and proselytizers, and I draw from both sides." And I think that explains a lot of our experiences. We have our polygamous in our... For many of us, we have polygamous ancestors, and we understand that extremism is in our blood too. And so I hope that as we talk in today, that we'll look at ourselves wherever we are on the spectrum to see that we all can fall prey to extremism and harming others. Thanks.
So we've heard about some polygamous groups, and I'm a polygamist. So how many people just had their stomach turned? That's what I thought.
Can we hold it up?
I'm probably not the most popular person here, but I'd like to share some of my experiences in getting where I am, and experiences in being where I am in the community that I'm involved with. But I'd like to start with, I was born in Pennsylvania as a Catholic with a Catholic mother and a Lutheran father, and my father agreed before he got married. He agreed with the priest and signed a paper that my mother's children could be raised as Catholic. So I was raised as a Catholic. 1989, two Mormon missionaries were on my door, on my doorstep, when I went home from work. I was 23, 24, and I invited them in because I spoke to all of the religious fanatics that came around, the Jehovah's Witnesses. We had a Baptist guy who wanted everybody to come to his church, and I had my own beliefs that I had formulated through my Catholic upbringing, and they consisted of a lot of Christianity. But some of the things that I was really particular about was I was offended by infant baptism because I was 23, 24. I was at the age where I was looking at life. I had two kids. I could have really used a good baptism, a good cleansing. But I already had it. And the Bible says there's one baptism. I had my one. And now I really needed it. The Catholic Church wasn't there for me. I was offended that my parents felt that I wasn't qualified to go to heaven when I was born, and that because they had me baptized then, I wasn't able to get a baptism at that point. I did not believe that the Pope was infallible. I didn't believe the doctrine of infallibility at all. Made me a pretty bad Catholic. The keys that were talked about in the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church claims to have those keys of Peter, that whatever they sealed on earth would be sealed in heaven. And the only thing I could imagine that could be sealed on earth that would be sealed in heaven was marriage, because the only thing we take with us is our relationships. So I believed in eternal marriage. I despised infant baptism, and I did not believe in the doctrine of infallibility. So these missionaries come into my house. Tell me about Joseph Smith. Yeah, whatever. Sounds kind of crazy. Angels and whatnot. Give me the Book of Mormon. I'm like, cool. I've never seen one of these before. They asked me when I want to be baptized. I'm like, really? You know some hick out of Utah? And talk me into being baptized into another church? I mean, I have my beliefs. But I open my Book of Mormon, I read one verse. And I don't remember the verse. I wish I did, but I read one verse and I was immediately struck that this book was not written by this Joseph Smith character. It was either written by God to draw me closer to him or written by Lucifer to draw me away from God. But either way, I was going to read it because I just soaked this kind of stuff up. So I proceeded to read the Book of Mormon. It had some really good stuff in it. When I read the Moroni's, I think it's in Mormon 8, about infant baptism, I was like, that is exactly how I feel. It's got to be an abomination to God to think that babies can't go to heaven. So I read this. As soon as I was done with the Book of Mormon, I had an intense desire to read the New Testament. So I got the New Testament out. I read the New Testament front to back. I just wanted to absorb everything I could about Mormonism. So the missionaries are coming to my house. I'm getting books. I'm getting Truth Restored. I'm reading Jesus the Christ by Talmage. Was the most amazing book I had ever read at that point in my life. I just wanted to learn as much as I could about Jesus. I lived next to some anti-Mormons, and they gave me some tracts, little tracts about Mormonism, telling me things like Brigham Young taught that Adam was God. That was unusual. I had not heard that in Catholicism. Joseph Smith had more than one wife. Really? I mean, at that point in my life, I really had, there was like a paragraph about Mormons in my history book in high school. That was all I knew. And I had a joke. I was like, there's only two things I know about Mormons. One, they have more than one wife. And two, I want to be one. I had never met a Mormon. I didn't know anything about them. It was a joke. The fact that I actually am here today probably makes it all the more funny. But I was reading these tracts, and it had footnotes into the Journal of Discourses. And so I went to the LDS meeting house and then the library, and they had a set of the Journal of Discourses. And so I started signing out volumes of the Journal of Discourses, and I started reading the things that Brigham Young taught. And I started understanding, and I had a testimony of plural marriage. And I started reading about Adam God, and it made sense to me. And so I believed in Adam God, and I believed in plural marriage. And I, I spent like 3 months, and I studied more about Mormonism in those 3 months than you can imagine. And I finally decided to take Moroni's promise. I'm like, I need to know. I was a drummer in a rock band. I had hair down to here. I smoked, I drank, I did drugs. I was not the ideal Mormon candidate. But I figured God will answer my prayers as much as anybody else's. So I went up to my bedroom with my little blue paperback Book of Mormon with all my little things highlighted and underlined, and I went to get down on my knees to ask if it was true. And before I ever got on my knees, it hit me like a ton of bricks that this is true and that God wants me to be a Mormon. And this is crazy. I've got my bar is as big as this. I've got half gallons of top shelf liquor. I could mix a mean drink. I was smoking stuff that it's only now becoming legal. I mean, I did it back before it was cool, I guess. I don't know. So I need to become a Mormon. I need to quit smoking. I need to quit drinking. So I give up my alcohol. I give up my coffee. I give up my cigarettes. That was the hardest. Well, now, I don't have a whole lot of friends in the church. I have the two missionaries. But all of my friends that I associated with, the Catholics that I associated with, my family, my Catholic family, the guys I hung out with, the band I was in, I had several interventions. I came home from work one day, there's like 17 people in my house, all my friends. They're like, you can't join this church, you know, it's wacko. And I'm like, but God told me. And so we have this long conversation, and you know, I'm pretty adamant that God told me I'm supposed to join his church, so I did. And so my friends fall to the side. They don't want to hang out with me anymore because I'm not buying beer and I'm not mixing drinks and I'm not smoking out of a plastic bag or paper bag, plastic bag, whatever we were smoking out of. But I didn't fit into their society anymore, and so they I don't know if you could say they disfellowshipped me. I was a lost boy from that group. These were my friends that I was close with, and they weren't. There was no religion there, but I was ostracized. But I still had my family, or so I thought. I come home from work one day, and my aunt's there. My aunt's a nun. She's got the full black habit, everything, Sister Angela Joseph. Outrageously Catholic, you know? She's here to talk me out of it. So I have this long conversation with her about why I'm becoming a Mormon. And it doesn't sit real well with her. Now, we did discuss some things that actually took. We talked about prayer and not praying in vain repetitions, but in actually saying what you feel to God, because in Catholicism, all I had ever been taught was repeating this prayer, you know, saying 10 Our Fathers over and over and over again. I didn't see the point in it. And I explained that to her, and later, years later, actually, I saw her praying, and she actually prayed a prayer where she said words that weren't written and expressed her feelings to God, and I was amazed. But my Catholic family, once I decided to become a Mormon, my Catholic family abandoned me. I mean, they didn't. If you're not Catholic, you can't go to heaven. Now, if you're LDS, you might know that if you're not LDS, you can't go to heaven. But if you're Catholic, you'd be very much aware that if you're not Catholic, you can't go to heaven. And so I was no longer invited to family events. When it was my birthday, I would no longer get phone calls. So here I was, a lost boy from the Catholic Church. So I'm a lost boy from, I'm ostracized by my friends, I'm ostracized by my family. I'm like all alone. And so I'm going to LDS Church, right? And they are just fellowshipping the heck out of me. I've got so many people that love me. I become the scoutmaster. And the scoutmaster before me was the kind that would walk you through every merit badge and make sure you were an Eagle Scout by the time you got out, by the time you were 18. And I wasn't like that. I was like, we're going to have fun, because I was never a good Boy Scout. And we just had fun. We'd go camping. We'd You know, you want to learn how to tie knots? He'll teach you how to tie knots, because I don't know. But I know how to camp, and I know how to swim, and I know how to fish, and I know how to canoe, and I was a whitewater river guide, and I was a whitewater kayaker, and I would take him to Canada. We had a blast. And I was a scoutmaster for 5 years in the church, and everybody loved me. But I still had this testimony of Adam God, and I still had this testimony of plural marriage. And I started to research it more and more. And I was married, and I would share these things with my wife, and my wife was following along as I was learning things, and the internet was becoming more and more popular, and I was downloading information, and I had access to all of the Journal of Discourses, and I could do a word search on it now, and I could just study the topics that I wanted to study. And I was a fundamentalist by the time I had been baptized in the church. I just didn't know what one was. Not only had I never met a Mormon, I had no idea what a Mormon fundamentalist was. I'm in the church, I'm scoutmaster, but I'm substitute teaching gospel doctrine, and I'm substitute teaching elders quorum, and I was also the second counselor, first counselor in the young men's presidency, so I was with the teachers quorum a lot, but I'm teaching in class, and one of these days I say something about Adam God. I just thought everybody believed it. They didn't. The bishop's wife was in that class. I was in the bishop's office. Where did you learn this? Well, I learned it from Brigham Young.
Careful.
Yeah. This started a process where I really was a fundamentalist in my heart. I had studied, I'd learned what the missionaries told me, but I had studied the Journal of Discourses and believed it. And I had this testimony in these things. I didn't know that, I realized in church we were just, how many years was Lehi in the wilderness kind of stuff. And we didn't talk about these deeper things, but I believed them and studied them. But this coming out really made me realize, because when I was Catholic and I didn't believe in infant baptism and I didn't believe in the doctrine of infallibility, I really wasn't active at that point, being 24, but I felt like I was alone. Like I believed these things about God and about religion, but I'm the only one. But when I found Mormonism, I was like, huh, I found people that believe like me. All of the people that would go to church with me believed that the doctrine of infallibility was false. All of the people I went with didn't believe that infant baptism was right. So now I found a group of people that I fit in with that believed the same as me, but the more I learned about what they believed, they didn't believe the same as me. And now here I was going to a church of people that basically believed like me, but deep down really didn't believe like me. And I felt alone again, like I was the only person that believed these things. Eventually, I went out and visited your father, Owen Allred, because I realized the priesthood could exist outside of the church. And so I went to visit Owen Allred because I was pretty well convinced that he had the priesthood. And when I went and visited with him, I sat down with him for about 2 hours, and I was convinced that he did not have the priesthood. And so I went back to Pennsylvania. Now, before I went to visit him, my wife at the time had been following along on all of the things that I was reading and learning and believing, and we would discuss it openly. And she was going to go with me to visit Owen Allred. And about 2 weeks prior to our trip, I'd already made the flight reservations, I had already made the car rental reservations, I was our first time to Utah, we're flying into Salt Lake, driving down, visiting some friends in Provo that were at college, going to visit Owen Allred. She says, well, I've changed my mind, I'm not going to go. I said, okay. The fundamental principle of Mormonism to me is agency. And so she doesn't want to go, she doesn't have to go. So I returned her ticket, and I'm going to go. So I make some arrangements, some changes and some things, who I was going to see and when. about 2 days before I leave, she said, well, I changed my mind again. I said, okay, what? She said, well, you're not going to go. And I said, well, I believe that I found people that believe like me. And, you know, that having that association of people that believe like you is probably the reason most of you are here today, is because when you go back to your ward, you don't always have people that believe like you or think like you, but you come here and you have that association. That association is important. So I was like, well, I'm going to go. And she said, well, I'll give you an ultimatum. If you go to Utah and meet Owen Allred, I'm going to go back and live with my mother. Well, agency, right? I had to go meet Owen Allred. And I went, didn't find what I was looking for. I went home. She used her agency and went and lived with her mother. We went through a divorce. Try to wrap this up. Through that divorce, we had a daughter. And our the whole thing was about polygamy. The whole divorce, the whole custody battle was about polygamy. And I was given a court-ordered ruling in the state of Pennsylvania that I was not allowed to discuss with my daughter polygamy, plural marriage, or multiple wives until she was 18. I was excommunicated from the church. So, after I'd been ostracized and was a lost boy from my friends, and after I'd been basically kicked out of my Catholic family, and I had one group to lean on, this group of people that loved me, they kicked me out. Now, the whole polygamy trial became a big thing, and my ex-wife really enjoyed it. And she invited people from the press to come to church so they could get pictures of a polygamist in an LDS church in Pennsylvania and put it on the front page of a newspaper, which they did. I didn't invite them, but I got a letter uninviting me from church property. So I'm not allowed to be on church property to this day. So I still have my children. I'm taking them to church. I can't go in the building. They allow me to drive onto the property, let my kids go in, and I can leave. All of my friends, people like you, that used to love me, I brought their children up in scouts and helped them send them on missions. Now they would walk down the sidewalk and wouldn't even look at me. I was a lost boy from the LDS church. People wouldn't talk to me who loved me. My bishop blamed me when his daughter came to the University of Utah and learned that Joseph Smith was a polygamist. And she backed out of the church. And whose fault was it? Mine. It was his fault that he didn't teach his children what Joseph Smith believed. But I was blamed for the problems. I was kicked out. I was ostracized. I couldn't go to church. I didn't want to go to the Catholic Church. I didn't want to go to the Lutheran Church. I wasn't allowed to go into the LDS Church. I wasn't allowed to go to the temple. Not just to the temple, but just to the visitor center. Christmas time, I wasn't allowed to go and drive my children through in Washington, D.C. so they could see the lights. I wasn't allowed to. I wasn't allowed to talk to my daughter about my beliefs. They were, the church was, my former friends were. They were allowed to point out to her that I had lost my temple recommend because my bishop asked me to give up my belief in plural marriage and I wouldn't. I believe it's an eternal doctrine and that it's true. I'm not saying you have to live it. I do. That's up to me. You don't. That's up to you. But I believe it's a true principle and I won't give it up. I won't give up a belief in it. So I lost my temple recommend. So now I can't go to the temple. Well, do you know what that means to a 12-year-old Mormon girl? It means I can't go to heaven. I can't go to heaven because I can't go to the temple to get the ordinances that are required for me to go to the celestial kingdom. Not only that, but if I'm a polygamist, I'm an adulterer. That not only cuts me out of the celestial kingdom, that cuts me out of the terrestrial kingdom. That leaves me in the celestial kingdom. So the church is allowed to teach my daughter that I have to go to hell. And by the church, I mean people like you. People who were my friends are allowed to teach my daughter that I have to go to hell because I believe what Brigham Young and Joseph Smith taught. Now, it's easy for us to say, well, Warren Jeffs is a bad man. And he is. I have no doubt about it. The only time I ever thought Warren Jeffs was a prophet when I read and he said the Lord told him that he was the most wicked man that ever walked on the earth. And I said, bingo! That's what the Spirit witnessed to me when I read about that guy and I learned about him. Owen Allred, as far as I know, he was a good man. And the best thing I remember about him was when there were accusations of abuse in his community. And he admitted, he said, there probably is. I've got a large community. There probably is abuse. And I can't control everything. But if you point it out to me, I'll root it out. And I thought, I like that man. I still didn't think he had the priesthood. But in the community that I'm in now, in Centennial Park, Arizona, agency is key. I don't have anybody asking me to write my sins down, confess my sins to anybody. Before I was baptized, they asked me if I had repented of my sins. And I had. There's the water. I have complete control over my family. Nobody comes in and says, you have to do this, or you have to live there, or you have to go here, or you have to do this. That's my family. I get to raise my children. I get to teach my children. We go to church. We have Sunday school at home. We have the sacrament at home. We teach our children at home. That's where the teaching process happens. Nobody comes in and tells me, this is your monthly message. This is what you're supposed to teach your children this month. Nobody directs me to do that. I teach my family the principles of the gospel, of what they need to know. I have two wives. They have their agency. They both know me inside out, and they both choose to be with me. Now, I don't believe that a seal is a lock that binds them to me and that they go kicking and screaming and can't get away. I believe that a seal is a seal from God that has His approval on it. And at any time in this life or the next life, up until Judgment Day, I believe that they have a right to leave. If they decide I'm not a good man and they deserve better, they have a right to leave. And it's my job every day to love them and to treat them with honor and respect and to raise my children and their children with love and truth and light and to raise them up to be good people in order to keep my wives happy with the person that I am. Because if my wives leave, they take my children with them. Now, my church leaders aren't going to come into my family and take my wives and children away, which happens in some groups. But my wives can leave. And if any time between now and then they decide to leave, we lose that seal, that stamp of approval. So I get to maintain that. And I get to become a better man. And my wives get to help me to do that. And I get to help them to become better women. And I'm not going to tell you that there's no jealousy. And I'm not going to tell you that it's easy. And I am going to tell you this. It's not all about the sex. I talk to people on the internet, and they're like, yeah, the sex, this, and the sex. I'm like, you need to get over the sex. One woman, she's like, well, I don't care who my husband marries. I'm not sleeping with her. I'm like, that's insane. My wives don't sleep with each other. We all live in one house, and they have separate floors, and they have separate rooms. And I've seen polygamous families that are just beautiful families. Their homes are filled with love. I'm trying to wrap up. And there are a lot of very, very, very bad examples of plural marriage. There are a lot of leaders throughout the history of fundamentalism that are very controlling. And they want to get in your life and tell you what to do. And I have not met that in the community that I'm in. And even with people who make mistakes in the church, suppose somebody has premarital sex you would go to your bishop and confess, and then your bishop would either excommunicate you or disfellowship you for a year, and you'd be taken away your temple rites, and you'd have to take off your garments and not speak in church, and you wouldn't be allowed to have the sacrament, and you'd be punished. That's not the case in my community. If a young man or young woman commits adultery and they go to our church leaders and say, I committed adultery, first off, there's not an in-depth, detailed interview of, well, what happened and who touched who where and how did that feel? There's none of that perverted stuff. You committed adultery, you need to be rebaptized. The next baptism is 2 Sundays from now, so I hope you're there. We don't punish them. The punishment is in the fact that they've realized that they've done something wrong and they want forgiveness. And when they go to our church leaders looking for forgiveness, that's what they get. I'm going to stop there so you have some time for some questions and answers, but I'll be hanging out for a little while outside as well if you have more questions for me. Thank you.
Stan, when you said that your bishop blamed you about his daughter, I just thought, hashtag thanks, Stan Shepherd. So, all right, do we have some questions that we have time for just a couple questions?
I have a question for Sujane and for Stan. How do you work through that, right? How do you respond and how do you, without responding fundamentally, right, in terms of those sorts of family conflicts? I mean, I have family members don't talk to me, right? And so how do you work through it? And what do you think the purpose of polygamy, what do you believe the purpose of polygamy is that monogamy doesn't serve?
Okay, I feel like families have to have boundaries. And if there are conversations that hurt and are painful, that you put a boundary around that and you say, we will not be talking about that. And I think with some siblings, that means you can only talk about the weather, but that's still talking, right? I don't know if that's helpful. I'm really not very good at it. Next.
My experience is that life is an opportunity to learn. And when I was married with 2 children, life had gotten easy. I mean, I had 2 children that were well-behaved, and a wife that was well-behaved, and I was well-behaved, and we all went to work and did our thing and went to school, and life was easy. I could have coasted to the end. With 2 wives and 5 children, 4 of them 3 and under, 3 of them in diapers, I've got a lot to deal with. I've got a lot on my plate. I've got a job. I've got church responsibilities. I've got an acre of land to take care of. I've got no teenage boys to help me. I've got 2 wives that one was raised in the community and the other wasn't. She's a convert that was raised in San Diego. And so I've got her family to deal with and to teach because they don't understand what's going on. My plate is so full and I'm learning so much every day that it just amazes me when I look at some of the other families in our community that have 3 wives and 12 kids or larger, how they make it work. And some men run. They get a job in North Dakota and run and let their family do whatever it does. And I've had opportunities to do that as well. It's about family for me. And it's about my opportunity to learn and to grow, and my wives as well. And so you could juggle 1 ball, but juggling 7 balls is different.
Any other questions?
Okay. Are your wives allowed to sleep with each other? Or
my wives don't want to sleep with each other.
If they wanted to.
I don't know. I mean, if they wanted to, I don't know that I could stop them.
Okay.
You know, I go to work during the day. If they wanted to sleep with each other and did, they could do it behind my back. They could do it in front of me. I made an eternal commitment, a covenant with each of them. And that covenant is basically to meet them where they are and to elevate them as best I can within their comfort zone. I mean, I don't force anybody to be perfect today because I'm not perfect.
But if that's what they wanted to do, I wouldn't divorce them. I mean, what would you want me to do?
No, I'm just wondering, are they covenanted together?
They're not covenanted together. They're each covenanted to me.
Okay.
And those types of relationships are not part of our doctrine or our understanding of eternal marriage. And so I wouldn't encourage it. I probably wouldn't condone it. I probably wouldn't condemn it either.
I'll take some of the heat off of you if everyone, you said everyone's mad at you. I'm also polyamorous, so I there's three of us in our relationship. But I just was wondering, we don't have the one-on-one. We have, you know, I'm not the only one in this room that has fantasized about a threesome. In Southern California, you can go from really poor to 1% if you can have three earners. We have a great thing, but we don't have a priesthood thing. So,
and we believe we have a priesthood thing.
Yeah.
Go ahead, and then here, and then here. Go ahead.
What if one of the women wanted another husband?
Well, I would be out of the relationship at that point. I have friends. I know a woman that has two husbands. That's their choice. They're friends. You know, I don't condemn them for it. I don't believe that it's a priesthood thing, but I believe that everybody has a right to. I mean, we're only here for, some of us, only 30, 40, 50 years. Some of us for 100 years. Learn as much as you can. Have a good time. You know, do what. I would not encourage anybody to stay in a polygamous relationship if they did not feel comfortable in it. And if one of my wives came to me and said, I believe I belong with a different man, a different husband, or I want to have two husbands, I would be out of the relationship. I would choose out. But she could choose in. I wouldn't stop her. I'd encourage her and help her, whatever she needed.
Last question right up here.
This is for Lindsay and Courtney. You're both bloggers. How does the anonymity of the internet
She's asking us, me and Lindsay, about being bloggers and how there's hostility on the internet. So I recently said that one of the biggest reasons I have gone through a sort of a faith crisis or a faith transition, you know, whatever we're calling it, is because of the hostility that I have experienced with women of my faith on the internet. It's hard to take, you know. It's one thing for a woman across the world to say you voted for Obama or whatever, but when women of my own faith say you've lost your morality and you've lost your sense of moral belonging to our faith because you voted for Obama, it hurts far worse. And so I wouldn't say that blogging has been good for my faith.
Don't tell everybody you voted for Obama.
I'm like Stan in that being with Mormon fundamentalists have made me feel a sense of community that I've lacked in the LDS faith, because they've given me language. They Ann Wild can attest to this. There's a lot of people that call themselves independents. They don't subscribe to like priesthood leadership necessarily, and I'm like, that's me. I'm independent. I'm an independent LDS, and I really, really love that language. And I guess blogging has made me become an independent LDS because I felt part of a community, and the community was telling me over and over and over, "You're not part of us if you say this." And so, meeting Mormon fundamentalists who say, yeah, I am, but this is my, I'm just independent, but I'm still part of this language. That is kind of how I've dealt with it. If these people want to say I'm not part of them, that's cool, you know, but I'm going to claim my own label. And it's not always easy. People on the internet are terrible in general. Like, you guys be nice when you get online, for real, because I've done it myself. If you have a username, you can be more sarcastic and more flippant, and we just like to burn people down in a way that we wouldn't do it in person, and I've been part of it. And it's something about the internet I think sociologists are going to study years from now. But it's unfortunate to be on the receiving end of that, and it's even more unfortunate to have it be about your faith, because that's the community we grew up thinking these are our people. And to be told because you have something that diverges that you're not their people, it's really hard to take. So just be independent. That's what I think.
Can we get one more hand for our panel?